Welcome to Binge-topia. We hope you enjoy your stay.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Binge-topia.
Hello, and welcome back.
We have a very exciting episode for you today.
And we're very excited about it.
I'm still recovering from my tooth BBL.
Yeah, it seems really heinous.
It's really heinous.
I feel like at this point it should be over.
Yeah, I got a tooth removed and a bone graft. It's not a BBL, but like I got my tooth done, I guess. And it hurts. There's like a huge hole in my mouth and it still really hurts.
Skinny.
And people don't realize how much tooth pain hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts so bad. When I got my wisdom teeth out, oh, I got dry socket. It was so fucking painful.
No, I feel like tooth problems and ear problems are the two things that people underestimate how much they hurt, and they really do hurt.
True. Ear problems are painful.
Yeah. So last week on our Patreon, our bonus episode was ASMR.
Bitches were mad.
Honestly, though, I'm kind of thrilled at the response because looking at the Patreon comments and our DMs, it is pretty 50-50 in terms of half of the people are like, wow, I love this. I want more episodes of this. Like, I could listen to this forever. And the other half of the people are like, if I hear one more mouth noise, I will shoot myself. But I think it's very funny. And sometimes we do things that you don't like.
And that's okay.
We had our little whisper era.
Yeah.
And whisper era is over to all of you ASMR haters.
It is over.
Don't worry about it. Mercury retrograde is happening right now. And I feel like it's fucking up my life.
Is that what's happening right now?
Yeah, because so there was like a shadow period for a few weeks, but now I think we are fully in the retrograde. And usually this ends up like fucking it because it's Mercury, which is like the planet of communication and travel and all this stuff. So naturally my car fucking broke down the other day and I had to go get it fixed for many dollars.
I feel like everything's always in retrograde. Like, something's always behaving kookily.
There's always something that you can look up at the sky and be like, fuck you. That's why this is happening to me.
It's definitely not my mental illness.
It's not your mental illness, babe. It's Mercury.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything. Oh, I saw this really funny video on Twitter yesterday that was people in the 1980s getting really mad that the seatbelt law was instated. They were like so angry. They were like, my shirt is getting all wrinkled because I have to wear this seatbelt and it's really ruining my vibe.
That reminds me of like the libertarian debate where the guy was like, the question is, do you think people should have a license to drive a car? And the guy's like, a license to drive a car? What's next? A license to have toast in my own toaster? And then the one guy who's like, Gary something, he was like a pretty big libertarian candidate last election cycle. And he was like, a license to drive? I mean, I would like to see some competency exhibited. And then the entire crowd goes, boo.
America's the stupidest country on earth.
It was just so funny.
The way that the government is actually just those town hall meetings from Parks and Recreation. Yeah.
Oh my god, that one Borat bit where he's talking about like putting a mosque in this like small Republican town.
Oh, how come you need a license to go fishing?
That's a good question. My mother's father, who like famously is not very good at expressing like affection or emotion or anything, but literally on my birthday, on the day that I was born, he got me like a national fishing and hunting license when I was like a literal newborn. So now I can fish and hunt anywhere in the US that I want.
So how did you get a license if you were a baby?
I don't know. I think he like got my birth certificate and like registered me or something.
Immediately. Yeah. Immediately upon birth.
Yeah, exactly. So if y'all ever want to go fishing, I am licensed.
Or hunting.
Much to consider. Yeah, much to consider, truly.
Is there anything else in the news media that we're interested in?
Well, before we get to the news media, I do want to just have a brief announcement that I'm trying to adopt another cat.
You are.
And it is so hard to do.
Wait,
it's like
why?
Harder than adopting a child. Well, I don't know. When I adopted Harley.
You tried to adopt a child?
No, I haven't. I'm not that deep in my search for meaning. But when I adopted Harley, it was pretty standard because I was fostering her and then they were like, she's eligible to be adopted. And then I was like, well, me, let me adopt her. So then they just let me. But if you try to get a cat now, not from like a Craigslist place, but from like an actual like shelter organization, I'm getting mine from like Kitten Rescue or something. I've like been emailing back and forth with this woman for like a week because you have to schedule like an interview and then they have to come to your house and then you like have a trial period with the cat. And then after like 2 weeks, they come and check the cat at your house and then decide if you can adopt it.
Why don't you just foster another cat?
I know, I thought about it, but I don't know. I feel like I would, because you're not supposed to introduce your foster animal to the animals in your house. Like even if I know that I'm going to adopt it, I feel like I just probably shouldn't. But you know, my rationale of getting another cat is that I was reading all these articles about how we think that cats don't get lonely. Like, you know, we are pretty sure that dogs get lonely because they like howl and their owners are gone and stuff. And cats are presumed to be pretty independent, but actually cats do get lonely. They're just better at hiding it, aww, which makes me so sad. And like, especially because I have to like travel for work and stuff. And I spend pretty much, you know, most of my days at home, but I do want Harles to have a little companion, and I do think two cats may be better than one. So
yeah, yeah.
That's the direction I'm
going.
But
they didn't check out your house when you fostered a cat. I don't understand why they don't do that.
I know, it's weird. Maybe I will just do that and like have that little loophole. But I saw this really cute cat named Shiitake.
Aww.
And I'm really obsessed with her. She has like these short little legs. And she's very cute.
How do you get Shiitake?
Well, I have an interview with the woman today at 3.
Oh my gosh.
To see if I'm qualified to even have Shiitake.
To adopt Shiitake.
I know, we'll have to see. I hope Harley is on her best behavior.
Yeah, Harley's like acting feral and they're like, you clearly have not done a good job with this cat.
I know, Harley, just like, it's like when little kids get upset that they're about to have a sibling.
Yeah.
But I feel like Harley's gonna like the cat.
What if Harley starts mauling the cat?
I know. Well, that's what I'm afraid of. It's the other thing is it's such a process to introduce two cats to each other. You can't just like open the cage and like let them interact with each other because you have to like, I don't know, be mindful of the fact that the cat that you currently have has like set a territory and like cats are pretty territorial.
Uh-huh.
So you have to like keep the new cat in a separate space and like feed them separately. But like, behind the door, like it has to be like a week before you even like crack the door to let the other cat see your original cat. It's like a whole,
oh my god,
a whole thing. I know,
your apartment isn't that big to have that much cat territory.
I know, I'm gonna have to just like keep one of the cats in the bathroom, I think, for the first week or something.
That's why you need to get a little kitty.
I know.
When Harley was small, she didn't even leave her room.
I know.
She was in that little cage area, and then she started scaling the cage.
And then I was like, okay, time for
She
you
was, honestly, she knows. Had the mind of a mastermind. She started climbing that cage.
She's actually a really smart cat. I'm teaching her how to play fetch.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, we're not at a great level of success right now, but mm-hmm. she's learning.
Remember when you put her in that leash and she started throwing herself against the floor?
Yeah, she did not like the harness. I still want to get her that cat backpack so we can go outside, because I think, I mean, cats are meant to be outside a little bit.
Yeah.
Just, you know, she can be in the confines of her little bubble backpack and still see the world.
You don't
think
she's ever going to be on the harness?
I don't. I've still tried. Like, I've tried just, like, taking her up and down the apartment hallway, and she just, like, is not having it.
Oh, my gosh.
She doesn't like it.
She really started chucking herself against the floor. It was very funny.
I know. I was like, okay, you're self-harming, queen. Like, let's stop this now.
Baby horror.
I know.
New addition. Also, we have some ads on the end of our podcast so that we can make some money to make better content for you guys.
Yes, and we might also start doing host read ads, and we just want to let you guys know that if we are ever advertising something to you with our voices, it is because we actually endorse it. Like, we're going through a whole process where we like actually receive the products or subscriptions or whatever and test them before we advertise them to you
and try them out. You also don't have to buy the things if you don't want to.
You really don't have to buy the things. It's okay. I know you guys all have that 15 second skip button. You're welcome to do it. Also, you know, we are an anti-capitalist podcast, obviously, and at the end of the day, like, girls gotta eat.
We do live in a capitalist world.
We do live in a capitalist world. We do have to pay our rent and we do have to feed ourselves, and I have to feed my 1.5 cats.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't want to like just rush into it and have ads suddenly be there and our voices suddenly like reading ads and have you guys not, you know, have any discussion about it before. But we're still the same Binge-topia.
I feel like we're telling them we're getting divorced.
I know, but we're not getting divorced. worst.
We always have to have conversations with the listeners. Like, we're moving out. We're living in separate places. We're starting to do ads.
Right, right. But we're still the same Binge-topia. We're still your mommies. We still love you. We still hate capitalism. We just also need to pay our rent.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And while we're on the topic of things that might open us up to criticism, I have like a horrible habit of name searching Binge-topia. So if you've ever had a tweet or a Reddit post about Binge-topia, I've seen it and I've read it. And I read all of our reviews.
And it might have hurt our feelings.
Yeah, and it needs to be something that I stop doing. And it's, first of all, obviously one of our most popular sayings is bitches hate nuance. I am totally, Julie and I are both open to you guys like critiquing the things that we say in the podcast, as long as you're not like calling us like ugly or stupid whores or whatever. Like, of course, nuance discussion is obviously encouraged. Like, that's the whole thing that we want to, what we want to say. I do just like, we got this one review that was like, the hosts keep their sources paywalled behind like $9 a month.
Which we do not. We say the sources in every single episode. If you listen to what we say before we start talking about the articles, we will always say the article and where it's from.
Right. And the paywalled reading list is like what we have been reading and like educational texts that we recommend and also just like all of our sources that we've used on the podcast that month in an organized fashion. But they still are available to you to fact check us if you want. We do say the name of the articles in front of everything that we say.
And also, we on the reading list are things that we don't talk about on the podcast. So
yeah,
it's not like things that we're talking about that we're like keeping from you. They're not right, like even necessarily related to what we talk about on the podcast. There's just things that we've been reading.
Yeah, exactly.
And although bitches hate nuance, it is actually impossible for us to incorporate every nuanced point of discussion into every single one of our podcast episodes. And although we always want to be as nuanced as possible, when you only have an hour for a podcast episode, like, and some people have spent their entire careers like researching one topic, like, we can't fit that all in, unfortunately.
Right. And I think that there is some nuance that as people who care about social justice, we are obligated to include. Like, we really do try to keep an intersectional perspective, and we always welcome critiques about how we can get better at doing that. Like, we obviously are two white women who have very limited scope, so we can try our best, but there are just inevitably going to be things that we miss, and we always appreciate you pointing that stuff out. And at the end of the day, like, I also just do want to make it clear to, I guess, especially younger people listening, that we're not experts on most of these topics that we talk about. I mean, even the gender study stuff, which I have studied a lot of, like, my degree is not complete. These are just things that, like, we care about and that we talk about in our own friendship and in our own personal lives. And then we do our own research and we do fact check ourselves, and we're not putting out misinformation out there. But again, we're not experts. We can't pay researchers to do, you know, weeks of research before every episode. So,
but we do use legitimate sources.
Yes.
As you've taken those classes where you know what is a legitimate source. We're not going to like facts.net, like, we are using like the New York Times and Washington Post and reputable journals.
Right. But, you know, you can use our podcast as a way to like bounce your own ideas off yourself. And as Julia said, it's impossible for us to cover everything about every topic in just an hour and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we appreciate the discussion. Thank you guys for listening. Those were our little housekeeping things.
Yeah. Should we do our mailbox moment?
Yeah, let's move on to our mailbox moment. So I reached out on Instagram to ask you guys to submit stories about pageants, because Julie and I have been both thinking about beauty pageants and about, you know, we sometimes bring up the Victoria's Secret fashion show, which I feel like is beauty pageant adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who clocked so many hours of watching Toddlers and Tiaras as a child, I just felt like this was probably due and we wanted to do a bit of a deep dive. So I'm going to read our first mailbox moment today, which is called Southern Pageant Girls Make Do. Hello, girlies. Hope you're well. When I was 16, I entered a scholarship pageant hosted by my high school. I thought it would be a bit of a laugh and quickly realized that almost everyone there was out for blood. I was one of two non-white competitors out of 25 and the only black contestant. This normally wouldn't have been such a big deal, but in the 20-something year history of the pageant, no women of color had ever won. We knew this, and so did every white girl on the show. Because I am neither a dancer nor a songstress, my talent portion was stand-up comedy, mostly consisting of riffing on the racist marks I've heard from other competitors. The judges did not like this one, lol, but I had a great time. The talents were mostly dance-slash-song-based, with some notable exceptions, ventriloquy, color guard rifle spinning, and a girl who poorly recited Shel Silverstein poetry. The gown portion was a hoot, as some girls shelled out almost $1,000 for a dress, while some, me, got theirs at Macy's. The showrunners pronounced every name correctly except for two. Wild guess as to whose those were. I did not win, but my BOC, bestie of color, placed second. And to clarify, I did not dislike any of these girls because of their whiteness, only because of their racism and overt ignorance of it. Hugs, Indy. That's wild. Honestly, that's the boldest thing I can think of, honestly, is going into a pageant where you are one of only two people of color, where no person of color has ever won, and then doing a whole stand-up special on racism, even though you didn't place, which, like, we can think of obvious reasons why that would happen that have nothing to do with, like, your talent or your beauty or whatever. That was pretty badass.
Yeah, I don't know how many people do, like, a comedy special with their beauty pageant, but I do love that.
Yeah, me too.
Hotties can be funny, too.
True. Another thing that I thought was interesting is that you talk about how girls spend, like, thousands of dollars on dresses, and we're definitely going to talk about the preparation that goes into it. And, you know, you mentioned that you got yours from Macy's, which I think is girl boss behavior.
Yeah, I remember when I used to watch Toddlers and Tiaras, the mothers would talk about how they're, like, taking out a second mortgage on their house to, like, pay for all the beauty things that are gonna last for, like, one day.
Oh, yeah, dude, it's really crazy. Also, like, you mentioning that you had just, like, gotten your dress at Macy's made me think of, like, a traumatic Macy's experience I had when I was, like, 12. And we were going, my dad and I were going to the funeral of, like, one of his college friend's uncle or something. And I, like, didn't have a dress. And so, like, 30 minutes before the funeral, my dad, like, drops me off at the door of Macy's with, like, $40 and was like, go get yourself a dress. And I had to get, like, the most heinous, like, black sequin, like, junior's section dress that I could find. So that I just felt the need to share my Macy's experience.
A sequin dress for a funeral.
I don't know. There were sequins on it. Inappropriate looking back, but at the time it was really my only option.
I mean, how many sequins are inappropriate for a funeral, I guess?
Yeah, I think a sequin accent is okay. Mm-hmm. I think a full sequined dress, inappropriate. I didn't wear a full sequin dress. I think it was more of a sequin accent moment. So I am, you know, retaining some of my respectability.
Okay, that makes sense. Should I read the next one?
Yeah.
So this one is called My Short-Lived and Hellish Child Pageant Phase. Hey, Benches, when I saw your urgent Instagram story about pageant girlies, I literally sprinted to my computer. Do I have a story to share with you? I will preface this by saying I grew up BFE, Texas. I don't know what that means.
I don't know either. Texans, let us know.
Let us know. Where my graduating elementary school class was 30 kids. Oh, is that butt fuck something? Butt fuck nowhere?
BFN, is that what it's
called? No, BFE.
Butt fuck everywhere? Brokeback Mountain moment?
Stop. In my tiny ass town, pageants were huge, and when I was in fourth grade, a literal fetus, my absolute best friend started entering into pageants and winning them. My little 9-year-old brain was enthralled when I went over to her house and saw all the bedazzled dresses and the trophy she had won. I was immediately jealous, naturally, as an only child, when she started getting attention for winning, and even had the local news cover her in a story, because my town was that small. I begged my mom for what seemed like eons, and finally she begrudgingly agreed to let me participate in a pageant to try it out. I was so incredibly excited. My mom bought me a god-awful poofy lavender sequin dress. It was definitely over $100. After visiting a local boutique and me literally sobbing when she told me I didn't need it. When the day came, my best friend's mom helped prep me in true pageant mom fashion, because thankfully my mom wasn't so into all this pageant stuff and assumed it would be a phase. My bestie's mom helped us practice our routines, which were just walking, smiling, waving, etc. For the talent portion, I chose to dance because, to be honest, I didn't have many other talents. My friend's mom coached me and made up a routine to Oops, I Did It Again that involved 100% too much ass shaking and, frankly, a raunchy, sparkly pink bralette and booty shorts. When I practiced the routine in front of my mom, she was visibly disturbed and asked for me to tone it down. On the day of the show, my best friend and I got spray tans that were offensively dark, whitened our teeth with Crest 3D white strips, caked our faces in makeup, and wore the densest false eyelashes so heavy my eyelids were drooping. The initial portion, smiling, walking, etc., went fine, even though I was incredibly nervous. But the talent portion was where it all went to shit. When I got on stage and saw the judges, who, by the way, were all grown-ass bald men, yuck, like, what the fuck are you guys doing watching 9-year-olds in crop tops shake their ass? My mind went completely blank when the music started and I just stood there. there. I could not remember any of the routine, and I started crying and ran off stage out of embarrassment. The judges awkwardly slow clapped and called the next girly. Needless to say, I never participated in another pageant, but honestly, I now see this as a blessing in disguise. To this day, as a gay 21-year-old, I still shudder whenever I hear, oops, I did it again. Love you, Binches. Morgan. P.S. My best friend is in therapy working on her pageant-induced mommy issues.
Oh my god.
That's crazy.
I know.
Yeah, fourth grade is very young to have to, like, know how to do a whole routine, and, like, definitely I would be disturbed if my child was, like, shaking her ass to Britney Spears at that age.
Yeah, that's insane. Also, just, yeah, I always think about the judges, how, like, what are you doing as a middle-aged man judging a children's pageant?
It's cursed.
What are you doing?
It's just, why are they the judges?
I don't know.
There has to be a fucked up reason why you're the judge.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna get into talking about small town pageants at some point, and there's interesting politics with who they choose as the judges, at least for the small town ones.
Yeah, and if you couldn't guess, today's episode is about pageants. I'm gonna go take a Vicodin really quickly, and I will be back.
Okay, you go do that, queen.
I shall. Hello and welcome back. I'm gonna talk about the history of beauty pageants and where they came from and how they're problematic, etc., etc., etc.
Before we get into it, I want to know about your personal experience with beauty pageants, if you have any, if you knew anybody who's in a beauty pageant.
I mean, I grew up in Connecticut, so I didn't know anybody who was in beauty pageants or, like, did anything like that. I feel like it's more of, like, a Southern thing.
Yeah.
I watched Toddlers and Tiaras, definitely, but, like, I didn't grow up, like, knowing anybody who was in beauty pageants. I feel like the closest thing I knew to that was people who did cheerleading. And I feel like the way that they dressed up in cheerleading was, like, kind of similar to the way that they did in, like, I don't know, beauty pageants.
The crossover is pretty heavy between cheerleading and beauty pageants, I would say. My aunt was a competitive beauty pageant stress. I remember, like, whenever my dad talks about his childhood, he always talks about how much, like, time and money went into, like, keeping up my aunt's pageant career. I grew up in North Carolina, but not in, like, I was in a quote-unquote liberal bubble part of North Carolina, like, yeah, Chapel Hill, so pageant culture wasn't huge there, but we did have cotillion, which I think is sort of similar in my eyes. It's like you had to take all these manners classes and, like, yeah, learn how to dance and walk and, like, fold your napkin and shit, and then you would just, like, go to this fancy, like, event where you did all of those things and, like, showed your like, wifely skills, pretty much.
Yeah, we'll have to do a separate episode on, like, cotillions and debutante balls and things like that, because the whole thing that happened with Ellie Kemper and, like, the racist KKK ball, like, that's all debutante stuff, which is kind of different from beauty pageants.
Right, and, like, the virginity, whatever.
Yes, exactly.
The promise dances or whatever are,
they're,
like,
all
fucked.
Kind of in association, but the beauty pageants are different.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna get into the history of the pageants.
Please do.
So the first source that I used to get this information was Beauty Pageant Origin and Culture from PBS, which we love.
We do.
So the very first beauty pageants, there's some talk of, like, things happening in ancient Greece, like judging who was the most beautiful woman and things like that, but there was no, like, actual beauty pageant until probably medieval times, where there were European festivals where they would select a May Day queen, which is giving Midsommar.
That is giving Midsommar.
So they would choose, like, the queen of the May Day festival, and that was kind of, like, in some ways, a very, very old beauty pageant.
Right.
But the first modern beauty pageants were in the late 1800s. So P.T. Barnum, the circus man, as you may know. Do you know about P.T. Barnum?
That sounds very familiar. Hearing that name and also the word circus seems right.
I think
right.
He was, like, the guy that they talked about in The Greatest Showman.
Really?
I think he was, like, what they based The Greatest Showman on.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he held many national contests at his circus that would display people and, like, judge people or animals or things against each other. So he would have, like, dog contests and chickens and flowers and children. So they would be like, what's the, like, cutest child? What's the prettiest flower? Like, what's the strongest dog? Like, they just loved having contests and things like that.
Damn, bitches were bored.
They
back
were
in the
really
day.
Bored. I mean, it was kind of like country fair vibes, you know?
Right,
like state
right.
fair vibes, uh-huh. Where they would be like,
here's
who's
the best
fattest piggy of them all. But he had a handsomest ladies contest, but it was not very popular, shockingly, because 61,000 people came to his baby show in 1855, but, like, not many people came to the handsomest ladies contest the year before.
Okay, pedophilic culture.
Yeah, people were way more interested in the cutest babies than they were in the handsomest ladies. So in the handsomest ladies contest, the reward was if you were single, you got a dowry to, like, marry yourself off with, and if you were married, you got a diamond tiara. But these were, like, not enough of, like, it was not enough of a prize for Victorian women to debase themselves like this.
Right.
So this is, like, the Victorian era where, like, you could not show your ankles. That was whore behavior. Like, if you're gonna go parade around in front of people, like, that's not worth it for, like, a diamond tiara.
Yeah.
So instead he was like, how do I make my handsomest ladies contest pop off? He was like, I'm going to do it through photos instead. So I'm going to have ladies submit photos and the final 10 winners will get oil portraits of themselves painted.
Oh.
And those oil portraits will be put in a fine French arts book, the World's Book of Female Beauty. So bitches were
like, now that's incentive.
Yeah, bitches were like, I kind of want to be painted and have, like, an oil portrait of myself and be put in, like, a fancy French book. So many people submitted to that and it was really popular. And then people started imitating this format and they started holding newspaper contests to choose a woman who embodied the spirit of their town or city. So they would, like, hold newspaper contests and have women submit photos to see who was, like, the fairest lady to represent their town or city.
Interesting. Photos. What era was this?
It was the late 1800s.
So bitches were dragging themselves to get daguerreotypes and sit for, like, 3 hours.
Like, they were, like, paying $500 for a photo. I don't know how much they cost, but
no, they were expensive and it was, like, a big process.
The shutter speed was probably so slow. It probably took, like, an hour for the photo to even take.
No, literally it is, because my mom and I, like, got a daguerreotype of us when I was, like, 11 and it was so heinous. We just had to sit there.
Civil War vibes.
Literally big Civil War vibes. They looked kind of haunting.
I mean, this is kind of when photography was going off because people were putting their dead babies in Victorian pictures, right, and, like, posing for portraits, which was weird. Weird vibes. But yeah, so photographs, I think, were considered to be classier than, like, parading yourself around.
Right.
Yeah. So then in the 20th century, people started to be less puritanical and there were less prohibitions on women displaying themselves, aka ankles began to be shown.
Okay. Whore era.
Whore incoming. Era. Hot girl summer. And in 1921, the first Miss America pageant was held in Atlantic City, which is in New Jersey. And the reason why they held this was in an attempt to get tourists to stay at the beach town past Labor Day. So they were like, what can we do to make people stay longer and, like, extend the tourist season? We know we'll have a beautiful pageant.
Pretty girls on stage.
Pretty girls on stage. And so this is a quote from the article. Stressing that the contestants were both youthful and wholesome, the Miss America pageant brought together issues of democracy and class, art and commerce, gender and sex, and started a tradition that would grow throughout the century to come. So they were basically emphasizing that the women that were in the pageant were very, like, youthful and wholesome so that they wouldn't get criticized for, like, parading ladies around in their bathing suits. Mm. So they were like, oh, it's just, like, a wholesome American, like, beauty pageant where, like, wonderful and young ladies, like, parade themselves around to represent our beautiful nation.
And then we can ask them how to solve ISIS.
Exactly. Well, that comes much later. So in 1921, the first Miss America pageant was held, and it was advertised up and down the entire East Coast that there would be a parade of, quote, thousands of the most beautiful girls in the land, and they would be wearing their bathing suits.
Wow.
So that was very enticing to people. A crowd of 100,000 people showed up.
Bitches are horny.
That's so many people. Like, that's so many people. So many.
What year was
showed
this?
Up. 1921. Were there even 100,000 people in America in 1921? Wait, wow. Actually, can you please look up the population of America in 1921?
Yes, and it appears there are 108 million people in America.
Okay, but, like, 100,000 people? That's, like, a lot of...
Let me calculate the ratio.
Okay, well, it wasn't a percentage that is impressive, so we can...
thinking that the math would be... Regardless, 100,000 people is a lot to show up.
Yeah.
Especially in Atlantic City. Like, nobody goes there. No right. offense to those who are from Atlantic City. Anyway, so the pageant started with a guy dressed in a King Neptune costume, which is, like, giving Roman Greek god.
Yeah.
And he was surrounded by others in costume who were called the Frolic of Neptune, which included 20 beauties and, very racist, 20 black men who were dressed as slaves to take part in the Frolic of Neptune. So you see the racism very early on in the history of, like,
yeah.
these beauty pageants. And so the winner would get a golden mermaid trophy. So all of this was like weirdly like mermaid themed, I guess.
Interesting.
And they would get a prize of $100, which is not a lot of money, but
let's calculate how much that would be in 1921.
We love an inflation calculator.
Okay, so $100 in 1920 is equivalent in purchasing power to about like $1,300 today.
That's a good prize.
Yeah, it's a good prize.
So it was a good prize. And they chose the winner based on applause, which is like very funny because like you see in old movies like the applause meter or whatever. Like,
it's like in Congress when they're like all who say yay, like exactly. And then they just like go off of that and that's how our laws are made.
Well, also a panel of artists judge, but it was based on the two of those sure. things. So the winner was 16 years old.
Okay.
Much to consider. Margaret Gorman of Washington, D.C. And they measured her bust, waist, and hips, her height and weight, which I will not be sharing, but they did provide because problematic.
Yeah.
But they literally had like all her measurements, like she was like a prize cow or something. And she looked like famous Hollywood star Mary Pickford, if you've heard of her. Like she was like the it girl at the time. And the New York Times at the time said, she represents the type of womanhood America needs. Strong, red-blooded, able to shoulder the responsibilities of homemaking and motherhood. It is in her type that the hope of the country rests. Which is a lot to say for a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah, no pressure for the girly just, like, walking around in a swimsuit.
Yeah, she was 16
having
years
impeccable
old,
measurements.
Having waist was snatched beyond belief. The original BBL.
Yeah.
The original waist trainer influencer was right. Miss Margaret Gorman. But, so you can see that, like, they're using these women basically as, like, a nationalist way to kind of, like, improve the morale of the country. And, like, she's a good representation of, like, what we should look for in this country. And, like the cult of motherhood. And, like, first of all, already pressuring the 16-year-old to be, like, what a good mother represents.
Right.
But also that, like, a good mother should be sexy. And she should have a tiny little waist and a tiny little, like, frame, you know?
Yeah, the measurements are really crazy. It reminds me of the time that I walked out of the gas station. This guy told me I looked like I was from Strong Stock. Which I was like, can you
That's
just,
so
like,
offensive.
Yeah, I would, like, rather an actual catcall.
You know, this is unrelated, but, like, you know how, like, someone says something to you when you're, like, 13 and it, like, sticks with you for the yes. rest of your life? So I was in a school musical and the lady, the bitch lady who was measuring us for the school musical was like, wow, you have really broad shoulders. Are you a swimmer? And I was like, no,
and but I've now I'm going to be insecure about my
I've
shoulders.
I've literally thought about that for the rest of my life.
No.
Just like when this kid told me I had a mustache in seventh grade and then I started waxing my mustache. And so just think about that. The next time you say anything to someone who's 13 years old, they will remember it for the rest of their life and probably have to talk about it in therapy.
Yeah, it'll get burned into their brain.
Did you have any comment that, like, very vague comment that, like, stuck with you forever that someone made about you?
I mean, the Strong Stock comment haunts me.
That was, like, last week.
I know. No, that was literally, like, a few months ago. But I still think about it every day. Like, every time I wear, like, a pair of pants or, like, a little bit too tight, I'm like,
It's giving Strong Stock.
Yeah, my, like, butter-churning shoulders are, like, popping out.
But it's, like, you can see that, like, the fact that the idea for, like, the handsomest ladies came from, like, pig contests.
Right.
And, like, they're basically judging livestock. They're judging women, like, their livestock.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yep.
Yep. But yeah, don't say anything to young women because they'll remember it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then Miss America expanded as a contest. So it became pretty popular. But to protect against the criticism from conservatives, they were like, this is actually just like a really like wholesome way that we like to just celebrate the women of America. So like it's unsophisticated, it's youthful, it's wholesome. These are just like young girlies who are just very innocent and naive and just participating just for fun. Nothing sexual about it at all. Definitely nobody's getting off to this in any capacity, especially when we measure their waists and hips and boobs.
Right.
Which are definitely done by men, and that yeah. is okay. Because from the very beginning, there was this conflict between wanting to present the pageant as all-American and virtuous, but they're also, like, at the same time, they're promoting a contest where women strutted around in their bathing suits. So they're like, how do we make this seem better than it is?
It's very American to be sexy.
It's very American to be sexy, but like, oh, they're still virgins, so like they're not ruined yet. Or like, right. I don't know what they were trying to do, but they were basically like, if you think it's sexy, there's something wrong with you. Wink. So something really interesting was at the same time, the conversation about makeup was really expanding and like the whole makeup industry was becoming bigger. And so makeup was becoming more popular during this time period. but many people considered makeup to be low class and only used by hussies that were trying to make themselves appear like ladies. Like, it was considered very low class for many people to wear makeup because that's somebody who's not actually a lady that's, like, trying to make themselves appear more youthful. If you think about, like, what makeup does, especially in this time period, like, make your cheeks appear more red and youthful, make your eyelashes appear thicker. Like, you're trying to make yourself look more youthful and ladylike than, like, hypothetically you are.
Well, you're also trying to make yourself look, like, sexually appealing. Like, that's the whole thing of, like, the cheek flush, like, mimics, like, the response, the bodily response to, like, having an orgasm or, like, mm-hmm. the big lips, all of that stuff. It's very sexual. And I feel like during this time period, especially, it's like, oh no, these are our chaste little virgins that are up on stage.
Yeah. And these hussies are trying to imitate our chaste virgins.
Right. Exactly.
And so teens at the time were imitating movie stars and experimenting with makeup and new clothes, but that was, like, threatening to the social order. And so the contestants in Miss America were not to do that. They were not actually representative of the teens in the time period. And, like, they started having beauty pageants in schools to make students more interested in personal care, in which the teachers would rate girls' skin, hair, muscle tone, and general appearance.
Oh my
God. It's giving eugenics.
It is. It's already, like, traumatizing enough to have those, whatever, like, fitness gram standards when we were in middle school, where they, like, lined all the kids up and just made them run until they started passing out.
So the fitness gram pacer test
is a multi-stage aerobic capacity.
I was always so bad at that.
Same. Yeah. And they also, like, take your height and weight and they're like, we're going to use the...
Hey, fatty.
Yeah, literally the most incredibly, like, outdated and inaccurate scale, the BMI, and, like, tell you you're obese.
Stop. I can't.
But you can jump rope for heart and win those little, like, things that you can put on your Crocs.
Gibbets?
Yeah.
Anyway, so the winner of the Iowa State Fair beauty pageant in 1926 was admired for not wearing makeup, going on dates, dancing, or going to the movies. Love. So they were like, this bitch is boring as fuck. She has nothing to do. She doesn't have shit to say to anyone. She's perfect. That's why she's Miss Iowa State Fair 1926.
Sounds pretty Iowa to me. No offense to Iowa.
Yeah, they were basically trying to, like, create propaganda in schools that, like, the sexiest girlies rated by the teachers, not creepy at all, are those who don't wear makeup or, like, do anything, like, teen-like. And also, yeah, they would always emphasize that none of the beauty pageant contestants had bobs, because at the time period, like, flappers were wearing bobs, and right, it was considered very, like,
subversive
and masculine to not have long hair. So they would be like, look, America, there's still long-haired girlies that don't go to the movies or wear makeup, and, like,
they're... Or speak to anyone.
Speak to anyone. Then, post-war, things changed because more makeup became available, and it became a sign of beauty and mental health and, like, accepting one's femininity to wear makeup. So as we were talking about, like, the Avon ladies, all of a sudden they were like, wait,
we can make money off this.
We can make money off this. And, like, post-war too, lots of women had been in the factories in World War II and then were going back to their, like, homemaking appearance, and they wanted, lots of women were like, wait, I actually kind of like working. And they were like, no, 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 no. The boys are back from war. Time for you to go back in the house. Maybe put some makeup on. It might make you feel better about your femininity.
Right. Like, thank you for making the military weapons. Now back to your homes.
Yes, exactly. In 1938, they added the talent competition to Miss America, so women could be judged on more than just their appearance, which, like, okay, like, now you're, like, spinning a little stick in there, I guess.
Yeah, okay, sure.
But that same year, they also limited contestants to single, never married women between the ages of 18 and 28.
Okay.
So that's, like, a huge scandal, is, like, if Miss America's, like, actually married, and I think right, there was a case where, like, Miss America was actually married and, like, lied or had been married before, and they were like, whore,
but
renounce your crown.
But in 1938, if you're, like, a 28-year-old unmarried woman, aren't you, like, a spinstress?
It's giving spinstress. And in 1940, they established a Rule 7 that was later abandoned, that all contestants for Miss America had to be of good health and the white race. Once again, eugenics. And the winner basically would promote products and entertain the U.S. troops.
Literally the original influencer.
Yeah, she was literally just, like, a war propaganda queen.
Entertain the troops.
And, of course, she had to be white and of good health because they had to be, like, the all-American lady. God. To entertain the troops. I mean,
I'm so sorry that you have PTSD from the bombs. Here's an emaciated little woman doing a spin.
Yeah, and they would just make her go to, like, wartime bases. If you've ever seen Mrs. Maisel, like, you know how she, like, entertains the troops? Uh-huh. Like, it's, like, that kind of thing. It's like, oh, these poor men are, like, so lonely. Like, they need a woman to, like, get up on stage and, like, so everyone can sexually harass her and, like, feel bad about being in the war. But yeah, they later abandoned Rule 7, but that was, like, a huge thing. I mean, obviously they weren't really opening it up to people in general, but that rule explicitly was, like, whiteies only.
And like, now it's just like the unofficial rule.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that later. But in 1945, the first and only Jewish Miss America to this date since 1945, there's never been another one.
Wow.
Bess Meyerson was crowned. She won the crown after they revealed what happened in the Holocaust. They were like, oops, sorry about the Holocaust. Like, here's a Jewish Miss America. Like, it was literally like, oops. They were like, the Holocaust is so bad. We're proving it because we just elected a Jewish Miss America. Like, oh my oopsie. God. Like, and it was sorry that we turned boats away full of like Jewish refugees. Like,
it was the first and only time to this date that they did that.
Immediately after the Holocaust, they were like, yikes, we gotta do some PR about that.
And that's called reparations.
And they wanted her to change her name to be less Jewish. They wanted her to change it to Beth Merritt or something. Bess Merritt. And she was like, no, I'm Jewish. I'm not going to change my name. And then people were really anti-Semitic to her. And after she won, 3 out of the 5 sponsors pulled out because they didn't want her to represent them. And she wasn't, like, after you won Miss America, you would go on, like, speaking tours. Uh-huh. But, like, they didn't let her speak anywhere because all the hotels and country clubs had no Jews signs.
Jesus Christ.
So she like had faced so much anti-Semitism after winning Miss America that then she was like, okay, I'm joining like the Anti-Defamation League and I'm fighting against anti-Semitism and racism. And then she became New York City's Commissioner of Consumer Affairs and then the Commissioner of Cultural Affairs.
Oh, queen. So she actually like did something.
Yeah, she was girl bossing away. But yeah, that's like the first like diversity, I guess, in Miss America.
Yeah.
But then they were like, we have to be really like anti-Semitic to you to make up for the fact that like people were so mad. They were like, we're actually pulling out and like we're no longer participating in Miss America.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And then by the 1950s, many contests were held around the world. Like the idea of like pageants started to like spread across the world. In 1951, the Miss World pageant was founded. In 1952, when Miss America refused to wear a bathing suit in public, the sponsor, Catalina Swimwear, pulled out and founded Miss USA and Miss Universe. So that's when those, they were like, oh, you're not gonna show off your body? Fine, we'll create a sluttier pageant.
Wait, that's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so historians Colleen Cohen and Richard Wilk write, whether the title is for Miss Universe or the Crooked Tree Cashew Queen, don't know if that's a real title, but seems like it probably is, these contests showcase values, concepts, and behavior that exist at the center of a group's sense of itself and exhibit values of morality, gender, and place. So Miss America is always kind of like, or Miss World or Miss Universe or Miss Crooked Cashew Tree is like, what are we trying to represent symbolically,
right?
And like, what are we trying to fight against in terms of like things that are like coming up? Like, we don't want any woman who wears makeup or like has a bob or is Jewish or is a person of color. Like,
yeah, like women are always used symbolically to express like the aims and hopes of a nation, because you know, women represent like fertility, like what's the next generation going to be?
Exactly.
So like women are always used that way.
Yeah. And so this is something that I didn't even know about, but I read this article called 50 Years Ago Protesters Took on the Miss America Pageant and Electrified the Feminist Movement by Roxane Gay. And this is from the Smithsonian Mag.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically in 1968, second wave feminists protested the Miss America Pageant, which was very iconic of them. So radical feminist Carol Hanisch, who came up with the phrase, the personal is political, which is like the second wave feminist right. phrase. She came up with the idea for this uprising, and she was like, we can raise awareness for the women's liberation movement by disrupting the Miss America pageant. And so women were invited by the New York Radical Women Organization to protest the image of Miss America because they said, this is an image that oppresses women in every area in which it purports to represent us. And they called Miss America the degrading, mindless boob girly symbol. Which is true.
Degrading, mindless boob girlies.
Yeah, and so at this protest, there was a freedom trash can where women were to throw away all oppressive feminine beauty items like bras, makeup, wigs, etc. And we'll get into this, but this is where the rumor came about that women were like burning their bras.
Oh, yeah.
Which is actually not true and is completely a myth and like apocryphal.
Right.
But they were throwing away in the freedom trash can all these symbols of femininity that like in the 50s were forced upon women to like be more feminine.
Yeah.
They were also like protesting all the product from the pageant sponsors. Roxane Gay also mentions that male reporters were not allowed to interview protesters, which is kind of funny that they made that rule. And they also talked about racism in the pageant because a woman of color had never won. There was never a single black contestant, and there was never a true Miss America, an indigenous woman, like a
right.
Native American woman who would be Miss America and technically be like the true representation of Miss America. They called Miss America propaganda of the military industrial complex. They called her a death mascot made to entertain the troops.
I mean, facts they all around making, the board. They were making
so many points. Literally, like, this little dancing, like, death mascot to, like, entertain the soldiers before they go off to war and, like, yeah, get killed.
Everything's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine.
Look at the lady in her bra.
Yeah.
Go into the field, go into the battlefield, don't worry about if you're gonna come home the next day.
Yeah.
And they did all sorts of performance art. Like, this black feminist lawyer, Florence Kennedy, who was a very prominent feminist activist, she chained herself to a puppet of Miss America to show that women were enslaved by beauty standards. They were doing all sorts of, like, crazy stuff in the streets and, like,
a showing. Burning Man moment.
Yeah, they were doing all sorts of performance art. They were in their the artist is present era.
Yeah.
And so the Freedom Trash Can was a huge aspect, and this is where the myth of the bra burning came about. Like, this apocryphal story that angry, hairy feminists set fire to their bras and were like, we're not going to shave and wear bras anymore. So officials actually specifically asked them not to light the trash can on fire because the wooden boardwalk in Atlantic City would also light on fire. So, like, nobody lit it on fire because then they would burn the whole boardwalk
down.
Imagine
if they just committed mass arson of the entire Atlantic City boardwalk. Yeah,
but then male journalists who were salty and pissed and they were like, why can't Miss America walk around in her bra? They came up with this misogynistic idea when they saw women throwing away these feminine beauty products and bras in the trash cans, and they got all angry and they were like, this is unacceptable. Like, look at these, like, blue-haired liberal feminists who are throwing away their bras. And so retrospectively, later in 1968, Carol Hannish, who came up with the idea, said that the biggest mistake was making the women in the pageant seem like their enemies instead of those who suffer right. with us. So she was basically like, we shouldn't have been attacking other women. Instead, we should have been, like, trying to say, like, those other women are also victims of, like, right. sexism and oppression. And we should have been, like, more aligned with them instead of arguing that they were,
like, feminine solidarity, like, arguing against the institution and less against the it sounded like they did a fair amount of arguing against the institution, but, you know, then also implicated really heavily these women who,
yeah, but you can see how it's a little misogynistic to call her, like, I mean, I guess it's not, but, like, the booby symbol or whatever. I mean, I get,
well,
that.
That's like the design by the pageant organizers of what she is to represent, but of course, like, real women do play into that, and mm-hmm. I think that there's, like, a level of implication, but also recognizing that that is, like, an extremely gratifying in some ways form of validation, like, yeah. by the culture, and, like, if you are Miss America, that title of, like, I am the best woman in the world,
yeah.
like, that's pretty.
And something really interesting was that the next day after this Miss America pageant in 1968, the first Miss Black America was held only a couple blocks away in Atlantic City, and Miss Black America was started by this entrepreneur from Philadelphia, J. Morris Anderson. And he created the pageant because his daughters expressed that they wanted to one day be Miss America, and there had never been a black contestant.
Right.
And the 1968 winner, Sandra Williams, said, Miss America does not represent us because there has never been a black girl in the pageant. With my title, I can show black women that they too are beautiful. And fun fact, in 1971, Oprah competed in the Miss Black America pageant
really?
As Miss Tennessee. Yeah, so,
wow.
And this is the oldest pageant in the country for women of color. Which was
so Miss Black America is still around today.
I think that Miss Black America is still, I actually don't know if it is.
Yeah, Miss Black America is still around. The pageant has garnered the support of artists, activists, and performers, including Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, and Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, so Oprah Winfrey was in the pageant in 1971. And it's interesting too, because I was actually expecting kind of the 1968 feminist protest to not be really intersectional, but it seems right. like there were black women who were a part of this protest, like Florence Kennedy, who was the woman who chained herself to the puppet.
Mm-hmm.
And the feminists at the time actually were saying, like, there's no diversity in this contest as well, which is a big problem. And so it's interesting that, like, the next day there was a pageant held specifically for black women, that you can see, like, in the midst of the civil rights movement, like, all these political attitudes are changing about, like, what beauty pageants should represent if they're supposed to represent America.
Right, exactly.
And the last thing I'm going to talk about, which is the big story, was the first black Miss America, Vanessa Williams.
Oh, right. I listened to the You're Wrong About episode.
Yeah, I also listened to the You're Wrong About episode. If you want to know more about Vanessa Williams, it's a really great episode where they talk all about her. But so basically in 1983, 21-year-old Vanessa Williams became the first black woman to win Miss America. that. And she, it's confusing because she won Miss America 1984, but she was elected in 1983. But she said that she had no idea the consequences, both negative and positive, that her win would have. She was just like a smart girl who was also very beautiful, and she ended up competing in it. Kind of, she wasn't like super interested in it, and she ended up winning. She faced a ton of racism, obviously, from white people, but also criticism from her own community that she wasn't black enough. So basically, tons of people thought she wasn't a good representation of America, whether right. that be because she's not black enough or she's black and that's like not a good representation of white America. People were really awful to her, and she got persistent racist hate mail and death threats. Her family got death threats. Like, it was really terrifying. And this yeah. is in 1983.
Right. Like, where a lot of people think that that kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore, which, like, if she was elected today, the same shit would happen to her,
I'm sure. She's a very light-skinned woman as well. So, like, you can only imagine, like, how the hate would be if there was, like, a darker-skinned woman right. who was elected Miss America. But she said she also had no idea how significant her victory would be for those who lived through the civil rights movement. And although it might not seem like such a big deal, there were those who were, like, crying and said they thought they'd never see a black Miss America in their yeah. lifetime. So it meant a lot to people that she won Miss America. But unfortunately, there's always something racist that has to happen. And there was a huge scandal because in 1984, Vanessa Williams found out that nude photographs that had been taken of her when she was 19, she was 21 when she won Miss America. So like years before, they were going to be published without her consent in Penthouse. And she had no idea that these photos still existed. She had, like, did not consent, obviously, to them being published. And when Miss America found out about this, they gave her 72 hours to resign because they were like, this is horrible representation of Miss America. You should not be doing this, which she did. And the issue of Penthouse was the most successful issue ever published and made the publisher $14 million, which she got no money from. She, like,
that is so disgusting.
She filed a lawsuit against them and, like, ended up dropping it, but that Penthouse issue made the most money ever.
Would that be considered revenge porn now?
I think it would be. I mean, it was a photographer that took pictures of her when she was 19, and, like, I guess when she signed the form, like, he could use it for things.
But like, male photographers can be so fucking predatory. Like, yeah. you hear stories all the time, like, even today, of, like, men being like, oh, yeah, I'll shoot you. And then being like, okay, just take off your shirt. And then the women never get their photographs back. They have no idea, like, what copies exactly. exist out there, who they've been sent to.
Or they say they're going to destroy it, and they don't. I think something happened with Emily Ratajkowski. She, like, talked about that in an article that she wrote about how predatory male photographers are. But everyone bullied her and shamed her, and she went from being America's darling to a national disgrace, which obviously there's sexism here, but there also is obviously a component of racism. Like, white Miss America would probably be considered to be a victim and, like, right. would be like, oh, this is horrible. I mean, who knows? People are sexist in general. And when, like, you know, Monica Lewinsky was also, like, considered yeah. a whore, but, like, definitely an aspect of this was that she was already so hated for being the first black Miss America. People were looking for any reason to, like, cancel her.
Yeah. And that photographer probably knew that because she, like, her win was so contentious that, like, publishing those photos would be a really big deal.
Yeah, and so, like, so many other women, like, during this time period who were disgraced women, she was the punchline of, like, tons of jokes on national television. She commented...
Late night talk shows, like, making jokes about women who are going through shit in the news, like, need to be abolished.
I mean, the amount of jokes that were made about Lorena Bobbitt, who was a woman who was sexually and physically abused by her husband and then cut off his dick, as she should. Like,
yeah.
people made so many jokes about that. People made so many jokes about Monica Lewinsky, who was essentially groomed. People made, like, any woman who's ever been disgraced in the public eye has been, like, made a national punchline yeah. on television, and it's horrible. So in 2015, she sang a song at the Miss America pageant, and the executive chairman finally issued an apology to her, which she accepted, but it's, like, okay, a little bit
too late. What does that even do? Like, I don't know. She should get that money from Penthouse.
I know. She really should get the money from Penthouse. And so now in Miss America, there's been some diversity. There have been some changes. In 2019, for the first time in pageant history, all of the major beauty pageant winners were black women. Miss Teen USA went to Kaylee Garris. Miss America went to Nia Franklin. Miss USA went to Chesley Christ. And Miss Universe went to Zozibini Tunzi. I don't know if I'm pronouncing all those names right, but all four winners of those main pageant contests went to the crowns, all went to black women. And so in some ways, this shows that the definition of beauty has expanded, but also arguably, like, how much progress is that if black women are still severely underrepresented in corporate America and Congress? Like, is it really a ton of progress for, and I think people were talking about this too when Vanessa Williams won. Like, first of all, it's a light-skinned woman who won the competition. Like, second of all, is it really, like, so much progress for Black women that, like, somebody won a sexist beauty pageant who represents right. them? Like, obviously, I'm not a person of color, so I can't speak for that, but I think in some ways, we've talked about this before, where, like, the representation, the fact that, like, companies care, and, like, mm-hmm. obviously in 2019, the beauty pageants are, like, responding to public opinion and, like, political opinion that, like, there needs to be more diversity, and, like, that's wonderful that there is more diversity in these pageants and that Black women are finally being recognized. But also, if you don't see that actually followed up, like, with political action...
Right, then it's just symbolic.
Yeah, it's kind of symbolic, and it... I mean, technically, like, all the winners of these contests are still, like, very skinny and, like, able-bodied, and it's still mm-hmm. based on, like, physical appearance. And, I mean, they do make you do some, like, competition and answer some questions now more than they used to. It's not... I mean, to me, it kind of feels like, okay, like, you're making them answer questions, but it's still pretty much based on...
But they still have to walk around in a swimsuit and have, like, a 22-inch waist.
You can't be, like, not hot and, like, win these competitions. But I don't know. I'd be interested to know what you think about that, if you think that represents more progress.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same feedback that, like, Kamala Harris got. Like, I think... And I don't think, again, bitches hate nuance. I don't think it's just that simple. I do think
it's not bad or good, yeah.
Right, or, like, there are bad and good parts of it all. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think Kamala Harris is a great VP. I don't like the things that she's done in her political career. And, like, it's pretty fucking amazing to see a woman of color in the vice president office. Like, even as, like, that can be just a pretty symbolic victory... I don't know. I don't think it lies on, like, either side.
Shows some progress, but, like, we shouldn't be satisfied with that as, like, the most progress that's going to be made.
Yeah, I would, like, love for Kamala Harris to stop, like, prosecuting Black mothers and, like, taking their children away and putting them in jail.
I mean, it, like, I think we've talked about this with the Corporations or People 2 episode, where it shows some progress that corporations are now, that whatever, like, Uber Eats has a section for Black vendors and, like, you know, people are donating money to more Black organizations, like, good, but that's not enough. And, like, in some ways it makes you wonder, like, are they just trying to placate people and be like, is this enough for you?
Like, yeah, well, it's like in DC when Mayor Bowser painted Black Lives Matter on, like, on a street and made, like, renamed a street to Black Lives Matter, but was still, like, gassing protesters and stuff. It's like, mm-hmm. well, this is all pretty symbolic.
Yeah, and people were like, so you named the street Black Lives Matter Street, but, like, no actual political action has been taken.
Right, and I think the danger is that a lot of, especially, like, white liberals are satiated by those mm-hmm. sort of symbolic victories, and that is, like, what makes them feel comfortable and not want to push for further, like, more revolutionary action.
Exactly.
There is some value in the symbolism. Like, I don't think either of us are saying that there's not, but it's just, as you're saying, not enough and not adequate for somebody to just, like, win a competition with very racist roots rather than perhaps, like, rebuilding the competition in a way that more accurately and adequately represents all women.
Yeah, and I mean, Miss America's always been, I mean, there was this whole thing too where Donald Trump went into the Miss America dressing room and was, like, sexually harassing the Miss America, like, it's always been, like men have their paws, like, in the Miss America competition, and, like, men are the judges, and, like, there's, like, obviously racist undertones. Like, I don't know what good the Miss America pageant is, like, still doing, and I'm sure you're going to talk about that with, like, the beauty standards that it sets, but, like, I don't think it is what we should be focusing on as a society.
Yeah, well, it's interesting the social function of beauty pageants, like, as you're talking about Miss America is supposed to be, like, the ideal representation of America, and that is, you know, where I'm talking about the symbolism being important, that it's not just white women anymore. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're still having issues with, like, it's only able-bodied women, only skinny women, etc. Mm-hmm. But the social function of pageants on a national scale is very different from the social function of pageants on, like, a community level. I mean, it's similar mm-hmm. in that ultimately they're still trying to pick a representative, but it's much more community focused, especially in small towns.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of wanted to talk about the pageant culture, like, especially Southern pageant culture, which I think a lot of is represented in Toddlers and Tiaras.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of the Southern beauty pageant culture is represented in Toddlers and Tiaras, which, if you don't know, it's a reality TV show that ran on TLC from 2009 to 2013. Every episode follows two or three pageant contestants who all compete in one pageant during the second half of the episode.
And it's been criticized heavily for obviously the sexualization of young girls, specifically around like the costuming and all the preparation. Like they get these egregious spray tans. They're in these tiny little outfits. They wear fake teeth. They have fake eyelashes. Like they're dressing these tiny little girls up to look like grown women.
Was it really only on TV for 4 years?
Yeah.
Well, it felt like it was on for so much longer.
Well, there's been
that.
A lot of spinoffs of it too. Okay. And they like do reruns a lot. But yeah, it was like they went on a brief hiatus and then came back for one, like Where Are They Now season, and then pulled it because people, like, it was really highly contested. Yeah. And so we're gonna talk about like why it was so highly part of the reason why. But I wanted to go through a brief list of like not actual crimes, but like crimes against humanity that have been committed on some of the episodes. So in one episode, a mom dressed her kid as Sandy from Grease in like the end selection and had her 4-year-old daughter smoke a candy cigarette on stage. Like that was part of her routine.
At least it was a candy. I know. It's so sad that I'm like, at least it wasn't a real cigarette.
Yeah. And then she had her daughter like chuff a pack of Marlboro Lights on stage. No. And then one mom was ordered by a judge to stop putting her child in beauty pageants after the mom patted her 4-year-old's chest and butt for a Dolly Parton costume. Like she literally gave her like fake boobs. In another episode, a mom dressed her 3-year-old daughter as Julia Roberts' character in Pretty Woman.
I remember that
like
scandal.
As like her sex worker persona, and the routine included a transformation from her like hooker outfit to like an evening gown. Again, this is a 3-year-old child.
3 years old? Can you even talk at that age?
Barely. Like I think like my 5-year-old sister, I can't even, like 2 years ago, that is heinous to me. And one story that you guys probably all know, because Toddlers and Tiaras, like most famous alumni, is Honey Boo Boo, who got her own
alumni.
But one of the things that happened in like the Honey Boo Boo episode is that her mom gave her this thing called go-go juice before the pageants to get her like excited and like have enough energy. And the go-go juice was Mountain Dew and Red Bull, which she would give to her, like, 5-year-old daughter.
The way that Child Protective Services was not called on
I know.
Honey Boo Boo.
Also, there's a hilarious College Humor, like, mini-series spinoff on YouTube called Precious Plum, which is so fucking funny. And
I used
watch
to watch
it.
That.
It's so,
so good.
Funny. Yeah, and then her mom would also, like, give her what was called pageant crack, which was like pixie sticks, so like just straight up sugar, just trying to like absolutely, because it's illegal to give the kid like Adderall, you have to like come up with these things. But I read this really interesting article called Our National Obsession with Toddlers and Tiaras by Angela Howell, who is a cultural anthropologist, and so she's talking about how popular Toddlers and Tiaras was. I mean, from its release, like, it had an average of 1.6 million viewers a week throughout its runtime. And the first episode of the spinoff show, Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, attracted 3 million viewers for its first episode, which beat out coverage of that year's Republican National Convention.
Honestly, Praxis.
Yeah, it was Praxis. But she talks about how one of the reasons for its popularity is that it shows a side of pageants that's not normally seen by the public. Like when you watch Miss America or Miss Universe or whatever, you see them when they're on the stage. You see them after they've done all the preparation, all the work, and there they are up on the stage looking beautiful. But the show, like, Toddlers and Tiaras, follows these kids like in their homes, like in their day-to-day lives. You see their family dynamics and like the whole process of getting ready for the pageant, which is what a lot of people find heinous.
Them getting their little spray tans. Literally, the term flippers will stick with me forever. Those
me
are, like,
too.
Their little teethies, right?
Yeah, and it looks so unnatural. If you've ever seen any of those like pageant headshots, it's like these little 3-year-olds with a full set of like adult veneers. It's insane. It looks so creepy. And also, Toddlers and Tiaras shows, for the most part, middle-class families. The pageants aren't huge events. Like, usually they're held in small regional hotels or local schools with an audience of no more than probably, like, 100 or so people. So this is really interesting when we get to talking about the kind of parenting philosophies and the differences between working class families and wealthy families. So in 2003, a sociologist named Annette Leroux ran a study about parenting differences between wealthy and working class families. And she found that working class people tend to parent based on a concept of natural growth, which basically means that, like, beyond basic necessities like food, housing, clothing, shelter, whatever, the parents kind of stay out of their kids' lives and routines. And like the kids spend their free times like playing outside in the neighborhood with their friends or watching TV or spending time with family, and sort of fill their time in organic ways, whereas wealthy people tend to parent based on a concept of concerted cultivation. So this sees bringing up kids as like a very delicate process that you need to be really involved in, and like it's really important to shape how your kid spends their time. So these parents will invest in in their kids in ways that might pay off in the future, like violin lessons and ballet classes and summer camps, etc. They're really structuring their children's time. So culturally, it's kind of fascinating to watch the families on Toddlers and Tiaras practice like extreme couponing and budgeting just to like dress their kids up for a pageant in like the basement of the Marriott. Because the whole point of wealthy families controlling like the skills and the habits of their kids to develop is to raise their cultural capital, right? Like they want to make sure they get into a good college and they have a good job and they have skills that are going to push them further in the future. Mm-hmm. So they spend a lot of energy figuring out how best to do that. Like piano is good, but cello is better. Cheerleading is fun, but gymnastics is more impressive. Breakdancing is trendy, but ballet is classic. Like they really think about how all of those things might translate in the future. So what this article says is that part of the reason why Toddlers and Tiaras can be so fascinating, especially for these families that practice this concerted cultivation, is like when they watch these mothers on screen, it's like, don't you know you're doing it wrong? Like pageants won't help your kid navigate the society. Like teach your kids a language or send them to prep school.
They're like, you're putting all this effort into something that like isn't even going to get your kid into school.
Yeah, isn't going to pay off in the future. Exactly. But what the mothers of these kid pageant queens and the wealthy parents of children have in common is that they're both practicing this sort of concerted cultivation just in different ways. Yeah. Like, you know, they're both projecting their hopes and desires about their kid in different ways. And I think part of the reason the show is so popular is because it gives people an opportunity to take out their own guilt about their parenting onto other people who are essentially doing the same thing.
At least I'm not spray tanning my child.
Yeah, but are like doing it wrong. And what this sociologist brings up is this concept of libertarian paternalism, which is this aim to manipulate people into making choices that the powers that be consider to be right. So like an example of this is, do you remember in 2012, Bloomberg, when he was the mayor of New York City, like banned sodas over 16 ounces or something?
I just always remember that joke in Parks and Rec where it's like a child-sized soda is the soda that can fit a liquefied child.
Yeah, exactly. But that legislation was an example of libertarian paternalism. It's like the state acting like the mommy, being like, no, that's too much soda for you. Like, mm-hmm. I'm gonna take this away because this isn't good for you.
Maybe the state sometimes should act like that and like, you need to prove to me you can drive before we give you a driver's license.
Right. But that's something that involves like the health and safety of other people. Like the soda thing is like really about like, here we are limiting your individual choices because we think this will improve your life.
And communism.
Well, it's just interesting because it's that same like threat of paternalism that keeps these parents watching and obsessed with Toddlers and Tiaras. It's like, oh, I know what's better for my kid. I'm doing the things that are the best for my kid and you're not. So I just thought that was really interesting. And then I sort of went down this rabbit hole of like small town pageants. Because I was thinking about, you know, because it's that thought in your mind of like, well, why do these parents like spend so much money on these like tiny little pageants and like, what's the point? And I wanted to get into more of like small town community pageants where they choose like a representative, like Little Miss, you know, Minnesota or whatever. So I read this article called Minnesota Queen Pageants, Play Fun and Dead Seriousness in a Festive Mode by Robert Lavenda. So this researcher looked into small town pageants across Minnesota in the 80s. His research spanned like 8 years or something. And it was just interesting to see how the social function of these large scale national pageants and the small town community run pageants is very different, even though they are both ultimately choosing representatives. So one big difference is that for the community pageants, the girls prepare for the competition together over a period of months. So they attend events together and they're trained in groups, very different from like the national pageants. And also there's rarely a swimsuit competition in the small town pageants. The organizers often stress that the goal of the pageant is not to find like just the most beautiful girl in town, but to pick an ideal representative for the community. So they try their best to desexualize the categories. Like they're being judged on the presentation of like their evening gowns or like their classiness. They have like a talent section. And of course they have those like dumb questions. But the main difference is that the girls, or I guess this is perhaps a similarity, is that the girls are presented not as like future wives, but as community daughters. Like it's like, oh, here are the children that our community has raised and they're going to, you know, leave and go off to do what they're going to do next. Because most commonly the participants in the small town pageants have just graduated from high school. So they've been entrenched in the community for their entire lives. Often like all the contestants know each other and know most people in the audience. So it's almost like a rite of passage. Like look at how well our community has raised these children. So the audience has a big investment in who is chosen to be the winner. And this often involves the reputation of the family as well. It's not just about the girl. Like in one small pageant in Minnesota in 1985, the winner was the daughter of like this very powerful and wealthy family in town. So when she won, there was like this huge outrage because the town didn't think that she was as qualified as the other girls. And they all thought that her dad like bribed the judges or something. Mm-hmm. So the community gets very invested also in like the reputation of the family of whoever wins. So it's like when we watch Miss America and like, quote unquote, the right candidate doesn't win, our favorite person doesn't win, whatever. That's kind of coming from our own individual opinion, which is formed without a lot of context. But the weight of the winner in these small town pageants is so much more extreme because these people have literally watched these girls grow up since they were children and like know their families. And also girls who are involved in the small town pageants are always active members of their communities. Like in research about the small town pageant contest, it was found that there were no candidates who were not involved in at least three of the following activities: cheerleading, track, cross country, volleyball, choir, yearbook, National Honor Society, student council, church, community volunteer groups, etc. So like they are all very deeply entrenched, and that, you know, it sort of does support the argument that it's less sexual and more about that, you know, this is the child of the community, the daughter that the community mm-hmm. has raised. And also most candidates aim to go on to higher education. And then in terms of like organizing the pageants, it's usually like 30 to 50 year old businesswomen or wives of businessmen. So they're pretty well off, and they're responsible for recruiting and selecting candidates. So they want to choose the people that will represent the small town well, like bright, attractive, ambitious candidates, etc. And usually the candidates themselves are not all from wealthy families. Some of them are, but not all of them. So it's almost equalizing to see them all like up on stage together, you know, like the teacher's daughter and the farmer's uh-huh. daughter next to like the banker's daughter and stuff like that.
But these are like teenagers, right? They're not toddlers.
Correct. Yeah. These aren't like child beauty pageants.
Yeah.
And, you know, the main function, again, like similar to the early stages of Miss America, is to like represent this idealized femininity. So they're not allowed to be married or engaged.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, why do they care so much if you're married or engaged or if you have a boyfriend?
Like, well, especially for these small town pageants where it's usually girls right out of high school, like the chasteness is emphasized. The sexuality is suppressed. It's like, you know, these are still young women who have not yet to leave the town and go off into the world and like, you know, grow up and get married and whatever.
I mean, it also kind of implies that like it's kind of like a almost like a parade for men to like choose their future wives too, and to like know that like they're not already taken, and that like you can see all the ladies in the town.
Right. But I think the fact that it's usually like the elders of the community who are there to like witness and uh-huh. be an audience to, it's like they are watching these girls from their town that grew up and, you know, are going to go off to college and have all these talents and stuff. Because ultimately, like, the pageant queen of the small town is supposed to embody the hopes and ambitions of the upwardly mobile small town. Like, it's not actually about who's the most outstanding or who's the flashiest. It's like, who is the girl next door who's going to grow up and be a good person and is going to be a nurse or whatever the fuck. You know, it's not necessarily, like,
who's going to be an MLM girly.
Who's going to be a LuLaRoe boss babe. But what's interesting is, and one reason why the competition in these small towns is so intense, is because the queen is not chosen by the community, but by an outside group of judges who are selected by the pageant organizers. So it's like the pageant organizers will like bring in their friends from out of town, or like, you know, regional celebrities. Like if somebody made it to the fourth round of American Idol three towns over, they'll bring them in to be a judge. So the judges end up having like way more in common with the wealthy organizers than the community members. So they don't have the same context as the audience when making their decisions, which is why a lot of the times like the drama happens in these small town uh-huh. pageants when like the incorrect queen is chosen. So like, why is this? Why does the community not choose? It's because the purpose of the small town pageant is to choose the best representative. So the difference between what will be the best representative to the community is different from what the judges think will be the best representative to the outside world, outside of the community. So the judges are selecting who will play the best, like, to the public, where the community members value, like, who will truly represent our community the best, who has done the best community service, etc. So I just thought that was really interesting and made me a little more hopeful about the future of pageants. Like, I think that small town organization, like, it makes sense for you. I mean, I don't love that they still have to like walk around in an evening gown, but I think it is like a good
like send off in some ways for like the daughters of the community to grow up and be like, and now here we all are and we're doing our little song and dance and we're about to go to college and whatever. It's, I think, like, perhaps there are some ways that we could like maintain a pageant and perhaps not make it a beauty pageant.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that like beauty pageants are any more sexist than like debutante balls or necessarily ballet recitals or like I don't think it's an issue of class. Like, for me, it just feels more like, first of all, I don't think you should be putting your 3-year-old into anything in which they're getting sexualized. Like, it feels very different to me, like being a 16-year-old in a pageant versus being a 3-year-old. Like,
totally.
I don't think you should be forcing your kid into anything, especially something where they're getting sexualized and like being put in public like that. Like, similarly, like, don't put your kid on the internet when they're 3 years old. Like, I just think that makes me very uncomfortable. And I do think that like it's very weird that they put adult teeth on them. And like, you know, people talk about JonBenet Ramsey all the time and how she was like a child beauty queen and like how that adds this whole creepiness to the story. And like, was it somebody from the beauty pageant that killed her because they were in love with her? And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just so clear, like, the pedophilic beauty standards for, like, the little kids, that's why it's so fascinating. But it doesn't mean that, like, there isn't pedophilic beauty standards in, like, all other sorts of things that people do. Like, I think it's also interesting, like, why do only women have these pageants? Why aren't there pageants for, like, young men to, like, be entered into society? Like, why is that
Some of you all are not eligible bachelors.
Yeah, and, like, the emphasis still obviously is on beauty. And I mean, people will say like, oh, cheerleading and like, I know that like cheerleading and ballet are like serious athletic sports, but like, why do women have to dress that way when they do cheerleading and ballet? Like, why do the men get to wear full pants and the women have to wear skirts? Like, you know, it is still, there's all these like sexualized aspects of it and like sexist aspects of it. And I don't think that that means that like, we have to get rid of them all. And I understand why people have these pageants and like, especially a sense of community. It's like a big deal for somebody to like win these pageants. And I know that it's based too on like your talent and like all these things, but like, I don't know. I just don't think it's good in general for young women to have so much emphasis placed on their appearance, whether or not that is like for community purposes or to be introduced to the community. Like, it would just, like, men don't have to do that.
Right. I mean, I feel like beauty pageants are kind of saying the quiet part out loud. Like, all young girls are encouraged to sort of like feel like they're on display and that people are looking at them as future wives and mothers and seeing if their waists are small enough and seeing if, you know, they answer questions correctly or whatever.
Also,
men don't have to be like fielded that way. Like, they don't have
have to be paraded around like the prize hogs. Right. Like, they just get to be. They don't have to be like walking around. And also, like, the element of competition and like pitting women against other women. Like, if you think about it, there's so many more activities for boys that are about camaraderie and like community and like Boy Scouts and like being on a sports team together. With girls, it's so much about like who's the prima ballerina, who's the winner of the pageant. Like, it's
right, and it's all very like rigid definitions of femininity too. Like, in the, like, you know, from that email from our listener saying that most girls did like singing or dancing or like reading poetry, like, those are the things that are allowed in the talent competition. Like, one of the things that they said about in this small towns article was like, there, a lot of the girls were athletes, like they were star athletes, and they weren't allowed to like do anything athletic or like show a tape of their athletic performances. They had to do something that was like basically drawing room appropriate, like playing a musical instrument or singing or something, and like they have to wear the evening gowns. Like, it's still like very hyper feminine and in these really rigid structures.
Yeah, and I mean, the toddlers and tiaras is a whole separate conversation. Yeah, it's like, that's really fucked up. I think most people agree, like, don't, like, especially just how encouraged young girls are to grow up so fast with the internet. Like, if you're putting like adult teeth on yourself in a huge wig, like, that's making you grow up like so much faster than anything else. But I don't know, I mean, it's not like revolutionary to be like beauty pageants are sexist, but like, I don't know, the feminists in 1968 did make some points. I don't think that we should say like, oh my god, beauty pageants in small towns are so much more sexist than like anything else that exists elsewhere. But like, it is just all, like, I wish that there were ways for women to participate in society and come out in society that weren't like emphasizing their beauty. Like, why can't they be a mathlete or like something? Like, I don't know. It's
more
not
girls in debate clubs.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's anything like revolutionary to say about it. I just think that like the emphasis on beauty, and like, you hear in Toddlers and Tiaras the mothers be like, you're getting a little tubby, like, to a 3-year-old, you
literally
know,
like, who has like stomach fat to protect her organs
because,
like,
she was literally just born. Like, and people put their infants in beauty. They have infant beauty pageants. Yeah, which, no, I mean, insane. Clearly they did since P.T. Barnum when they had, like, right. the baby. But it's, like, similarly how I feel about child actors, where it's, like, your child says they love it, but, like, they don't really know. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
It's just not a lot of choice. And at the end of the day, it is still, like, I mean, not saying that it's any better. In fact, a lot of times I think it's worse, but it is that parent just projecting their ideals and their desires onto their kid directly in the same way that, you know, wealthy families do.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, we would be interested to hear your guys' thoughts on it. There's obviously a long history to this. I don't think they're going away anytime soon. But
thank
also,
God Toddlers and Tiaras was canceled, though.
I know. That actually was starting to become, like, an ethical issue, but...
Yeah. There was this one, I am just remembering now, but this one story that I actually remember from an episode I watched. This four-year-old is getting her eyebrows waxed.
And she's
having an entire meltdown about it. And the mom, like, goes off, you know, out of the room to talk to the camera. And the mom's like, oh, she's being so dramatic. Like, it's just because last year when she was three, we took her to get her eyebrows waxed. And, like, the wax was too hot and, like, ripped off her skin. So she's just, like, traumatized from that. And it's like... like, also, I've never, like, I don't know. I don't even think three-year-old's eyebrows can... possibly be that out of control.
But. Yeah, and it's also just like girls are going to be introduced to like all these beauty standards and all these unfair expectations at some point. Like, right. Let them live a little bit longer without having to know about it.
Yeah,
like,
let them be free for just a bit.
Let them be free for just a little bit longer.
Free all child pageant queens. That's all let them speak.
Should we have our godly wife spotlight?
We should have our godly wife spotlight.
For those who don't know or are new listeners, our godly wives are our super patrons. If you want to join our Patreon to get access to two new bonus episodes a month, our live streams, well, actually, they're not live streams anymore. We now do Zooms where you guys can chat with us and we play games and we talk. And our reading list where we put all of our books that we've been reading and things we've been interested in. Sometimes we also put TV shows and movies, but our godly wives are super, super patrons and we thank them in every episode because they are our queens.
Yes, they are. So without further ado, thank you so much to Tess Williams, Nicole Pearl, Ruth Curry, Liliana Grassi, Allison Barkhouse, Kinsey Williamson, Kaylee Pittman, Grace Drudge, Chuck Wallace, Catherine Noble, Andreas Bezhalar, Summer, and Anna Hayslip. Thank you so much for being our godliest wives.
We love you.
We love you.
And if you like this episode, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at BingeTopiaPod. And if you want to email us something, our email is BingeTopia@gmail.com.
Yes.
We hope you have a lovely day. We love you very much.
We love you very much.
Bye.
Bye.